As this citizen army drew ever closer, the royal family left the palace and made their way to the manège, where they placed themselves under the protection of the legislative assembly. Here they sat in the tiny shorthand writer's box as a scene of carnage was played out at the Tuileries next door. The defenders of the palace were hopelessly outnumbered, and most defected to the marches, leaving the 900-strong Swiss guard to face the crowd virtually unsupported. In the confusion, shots were fired. The crowd engulfed the palace, sacking the splendid rooms and killing anyone they met. There were casualties on both sides, but the defenders bore the brunt of them. Some 600 Swiss guards were hacked to death at the scene or in custody afterwards. Body parts were hoisted aloft on pikes and paraded through the streets. The monarchy had fallen. The 10th of August, 1792, was a second revolution, sealed in bloodshed on a scale unimaginable to the men who made the first. Over the next few days, the new order swung into action under the auspices of the insurrectionary commune and the newly installed justice minister, none other than Danton, the arch-orchestrator of the rising. The royal family were transferred to the Temple prison. The royalist press was closed down. A special tribunal was set up to try political prisoners, and on the 21st of August, in the public square outside the Tuileries, one Louis d'Angremont, an official of the National Guard, became the first political victim of a new mechanized form of execution, soon to be called after its promoter, the one-time deputy Joseph-Ignace Guillotin. Intended as a humane alternative to the grisly capital punishments of the old regime, the guillotine would become an enduring symbol of the excesses of the new. In the days after the 10th of August, anyone suspected of loyalty to the old regime learnt to dread that emblematic calling card of the modern police state, the midnight knock on the door. Hundreds of people, including many non-juror priests, were rounded up and imprisoned. Meanwhile, news arrived that the Prussian army had crossed the border and was advancing on Paris unopposed. Thousands of sans-culottes heeded Danton's rousing call for volunteers, but what would become of their wives and children while they were away? The prisons, after all, were bursting with desperate counter-revolutionaries. What if there was a mass breakout? For days, journalists like Marat had been calling for the blood of these enemies of the people. Surely it was time for patriots to act. On the 2nd of September, they did. Over the next 4 days, the prisons of Paris were overrun by paramilitary groups wielding pikes, axes, and knives. Prisoners were dragged from their cells and butchered, usually after a summary tribunal. The dead included aristocrats, bishops, priests, and hundreds of petty criminals who had never been accused of political crimes. In all, some 1,400 men, women, and young people were massacred, half the entire prison population of the city. It was in this climate that a new national convention was elected to replace the Legislative Assembly. Its members included Robespierre and Danton, who resigned as justice minister to join it. The very day of its first meeting, the 20th of September, good news finally arrived from the front. French forces under Dumouriez had halted the Prussian advance at Valmy. Goethe, the great German poet and polymath, witnessed the Prussian defeat at first hand and was in no doubt as to its significance. "At this place, on this day," he told his demoralized fellow countrymen, "there has begun a new era in the history of the world." He was right. The next day, the convention voted formally to abolish the monarchy. The day after that, it declared France a republic. When, the following year, the revolutionary authorities decreed a new calendar for France, it was this day, the 22nd of September, 1792, that became the first day of Year One. The tide of war had turned in France's favour, changing the conflict from a struggle for the defence of the nation into a revolutionary crusade. In November, victory at the Battle of Jemappes enabled French troops to occupy Belgium, The Rhineland, Savoy, Basel, and Nice also fell to the forces of the Republic. At home, the burning question was what to do with citizen Louis Capet, the man formerly known as King Louis XVI. There were those in the convention, including Robespierre and his 25-year-old acolyte Louis-Antoine Saint-Just, who argued that there was no need for a trial. Louis had already been judged guilty by the sovereign people. "This man must reign or die," Saint-Just proclaimed in an electrifying maiden speech. "One cannot reign innocently. Every king is a rebel and a usurper." Nonetheless, Louis was committed for trial in December. Much was made of a cache of papers discovered in the notorious iron cupboard at the Tuileries, which incriminated not only Louis himself, but also the revolutionary hero Mirabeau, now shown to have been in the king's pay during 1790. On the 15th of January, Louis was found guilty of high crimes against the people. 2 days later, he was sentenced to death. On the morning of the 21st of January, 1793, Louis said goodbye to his wife and children at the temple and began his journey to the scaffold. The crowds watched in silence as his carriage, its windows shuttered, passed through foggy streets lined with thousands of National Guards. At 10 o'clock it reached the Place de la Révolution, today's Place de la Concorde. Here, in the square once named after his grandfather, Louis XV, he emerged and mounted the scaffold with dignity. The executioner bound his hands and cropped his hair. Louis began to address the assembled crowds, but his speech was cut short by the beating of drums, and he was lifted onto the guillotine. When the blade had done its work, his head was held up to the crowd, and eager souvenir hunters pressed forward to soak their handkerchiefs in the blood of their erstwhile king. If those who voted for Louis's execution hoped that it would promote national unity, they were to be sorely disappointed. Regicide stiffened international opposition, and within weeks the war had widened to draw in Britain, Spain, and Holland. Divisions at home widened with it, both within and between Paris and the provinces, and by early summer France was sliding into civil war. The trigger came in February with the convention's call for a further 300,000 troops, the revolution's first recourse to conscription. The draft was widely resisted, especially in the West. In the Vendée, where the civil constitution had met determined opposition, resistance quickly swelled into a full-scale counter-revolutionary rising. Soon there would be some 45,000 men under arms in the area, calling themselves the Catholic and Royal Army. The draft